Stay tuned for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Joe Palca reporting. The U.S. eavesdropping on France. The French president reacts to WikiLeaks reports. France is sending its intelligence coordinator to Washington following allegations by the whistleblowing website WikiLeaks that the U.S. spied on France's last three leaders, including current president François Hollande. Lisa Bryant reports from Paris.
Foreign Minister Laurent Fabius has summoned the U.S. ambassador to France, Jane Hartley, to discuss revelations that were published by WikiLeaks and by two French news outlets. They claim to show that from 2006 to 2012, the U.S. National Security Agency wiretapped the conversations of French President François Hollande and his predecessors. WikiLeaks and the journalists say more revelations will follow. The unconfirmed reports have sparked furor in France, although they don't appear to offer many surprises. Mr. Hollande convened emergency meetings on Wednesday to discuss the allegations. He said in a statement that U.S. spying was unacceptable. Lisa Bryant for VOA News, Paris.
The reports were published by French daily newspaper Liberation and investigative website Mediapart. Iranian Supreme Leader Ayatollah Ali Khamenei made clear in an address on Tuesday night that Iran will not accept any long-term curbing of its nuclear program as negotiators from his country and a group of world powers close in on a deadline for reaching a comprehensive agreement. Kurdish-led forces in Syria have captured more territory from the Islamic State group. Backed by U.S.-led coalition airstrikes, the YPG fighters with allied factions claim to have seized the town of Ain Issa. Now, true, that would put the Kurds about 50 kilometers from Raqqa, the self-declared capital of IS. This is VOA News. The Rwandan government has denounced the arrest of its intelligence chief in the United Kingdom as unacceptable and an outrage. At the request of Spain, Karenzi Karake was arrested on allegations of war crimes. Mr. Karake was detained at London's Heathrow Airport on Saturday and is to appear in court on Thursday for his alleged role in reprisal killings during the 1994 Rwandan genocide. Russia has been showing off its new combat tank design, the Armata T-14. Designers claim it is 20 years ahead of current Western designs, and test drivers say it's operating like playing a computer game. But military analysts question those assertions. Henry Ridgewell reports from London.
Russia's Victory Day military parade on May 9th. There was one new piece of hardware that grabbed the world's attention, the new T-14 Armata tank. Chief designer Andrei Terlikov says the Armata contains cutting-edge technology. Terlikov says the level of automation, the principles we put in it, represent a decisive step towards more advanced unmanned machines. But the marketing of military hardware should always be taken with a degree of skepticism, says Henry Boyd of the International Institute for Strategic Studies.
Where this puts it in comparison with contemporary Western tank design is something I think we'll have to wait some time to get a better sense of.
Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
Russia claims the Armata's so-called explosive reactor armor, or ERA, is capable of withstanding all anti-tank rounds possessed by NATO. The U.S. has criticized China for carrying out state-sponsored cyber attacks, a blunt accusation that comes as authorities in Washington continue to investigate a massive hack into federal employee data. This is Treasury Secretary Jack Lew.
On cyberspace in particular, we remain deeply concerned about Chinese government-sponsored cyber-enabled theft of confidential business information and proprietary technology from U.S. companies. Such activity falls outside of the bounds of acceptable state behavior in cyberspace. A more open, secure, and interoperable and reliable cyberspace is critical to free and fair commerce, and we look forward to discussing these matters further.
He said the U.S. remains deeply concerned about Chinese government-sponsored cyber-enabled theft. A new poll suggests the world largely supports both the U.S. defense shift toward Asia and the U.S.-led military campaign against Islamic State group, two centerpieces of the White House's foreign policy efforts. The U.S.'s overall ratings also remain mostly positive, according to the Pew Research Center poll. Joe Palca reporting from Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehiz Wuhib, and coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
The latest figures we have are that some 125,000 people have crossed so far this year from Turkey and North Africa into Greece and Italy.
That's William Spindler of the UN Refugee Agency talking about the flow of migrants and refugees to Europe. Details coming up.
Also in the news, security officials say there was a targeted assassination attempt on the life of a United Arab Emirates diplomat today in Mogadishu. And survivors say a suicide bomber killed more than 10 people in a northeastern Nigeria village yesterday.
We'll have these stories, plus the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young, music from Cameroon, and our daily features. So stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Security officials say there was a targeted assassination attempt on the life of a United Arab Emirates diplomat today in the Somali capital, Mogadishu. The attack failed. A pickup truck exploded when it rammed a military escort vehicle from the UN mission to Somalia, killing 12 people. The armored Land Rover carrying the diplomat was not damaged. Al-Shabaab declared the bombing was an attempt to kill a foreign enemy. Somalia has been racked by instability since the collapse of Siad Barre's regime in 1991. The current Western-backed government is being supported by a 22,000-strong AU force that includes troops from Burundi, Djibouti, Ethiopia, Kenya, and Uganda.
Hungary says it will suspend processing of asylum seekers registered within its borders because a rising tide of refugees has overwhelmed its infrastructure. A government spokesman announced late yesterday that Hungary has informed its EU partners of the temporary suspension. As the move runs contrary to EU regulations, it is unclear how other members of the EU bloc will react. Hungary's announcement refers to an agreement among EU members that asylum seekers may travel freely within the EU but must rely on the country they first entered to process their paperwork. Hungary has been hit hard by an uptick in asylum seekers in the past year. Last week, Hungarian officials announced plans to build a 4-meter-high fence along 175 kilometers of the border with Serbia to stem the flow of illegal immigrants. Government figures show Hungarian police have apprehended more than 60,000 people so far this year who were trying to enter Hungary illegally, compared to about 43,000 for all of 2014. Hundreds of refugees have died at sea as they attempt the crossing from North Africa to Europe in overcrowded, rickety boats. EU leaders are due to discuss this week how to fairly distribute the flood of migrants that have arrived so far this year. The European Commission has proposed relocating 40,000 refugees in nations across the European Union over the next 2 years.
While European countries debate what to do about the influx of refugees and migrants, there's no end in sight to those seeking safe haven from conflict or violence. They're traveling to Europe by either crossing the Mediterranean or landing on Greek islands. Just yesterday, 1,000 people were rescued on the Mediterranean by ships from Denmark and Norway. William Spindler is a spokesman for the UN Refugee Agency, the UNHCR. From Geneva, he spoke to VOA's Joe DiCapua about the refugee crisis.
Conflicts in Syria, Iraq, and elsewhere continue to push people to try to come to Europe through the Mediterranean, risking their lives in the process. And the latest figures we have are that some 125,000 people have crossed so far this year from Turkey and North Africa into Greece and Italy. The figure for Greece has just overtaken that for Italy. 63,000 people have arrived in Greece and some 62,000 have arrived in Italy. This is obviously very worrying because the communities where they are arriving are not prepared to deal with these large numbers of people arriving. and they are really struggling to cope, to provide them with assistance as they land, particularly in Greece, where they are arriving in small islands that are totally unprepared to deal with this large influx of refugees.
As you know, the European Union began its operation this week to try to target the boats of smugglers in the Mediterranean. Have you seen any evidence that this operation has had any effect on the flow of migrants and refugees, or is it too soon?
It's probably too soon to see any change in the patterns of people crossing by boat. From our point of view, any action that combats smuggling and the trafficking of human beings is to be welcomed, because smugglers are basically preying on vulnerable refugees and migrants and exploiting them, and in some cases endangering their lives and even killing them themselves. But our concern is that any action that combats smuggling has to preserve the lives and the safety and the welfare of the victims of the smugglers, in other words, the refugees. And also, it's very important that people have still access to safety in Europe and the possibility to claim asylum from persecution. This is something that needs to be preserved. So although we welcome actions against smugglers, we want protection for the victims, i.e. the innocent refugees and migrants that are forced to use the services of the smugglers.
You mentioned that the migrants and refugees were increasing on the Greek islands. Has Greece become the route of choice? In other words, are we seeing the same ethnic makeup through Greece as we have seen of those crossing the Mediterranean?
The nationalities of the people crossing into Greece are slightly different from those crossing from Libya into Italy. On the central Mediterranean route from Libya into southern Italy, you see a majority of people from sub-Saharan Africa, countries such as Ethiopia, Somalia, Eritrea, some people from West Africa. There are also some Syrians, but they are not the majority. On the route from Turkey into Greece, on the other hand, you see a majority of Syrians. About 60% of those who arrive are from Syria. You also see a large number of Afghans, Iraqis, and other people fleeing conflict in the Middle East. Nearly 90% of the people landing in Greece are coming from countries experiencing conflict or human rights violations.
What are your concerns about those who reach Europe? Is there any plan that is now in effect that deals with the folks that have been registered by the UNHCR and go on to other countries?
Well, our concern is that faced with this large influx of refugees, many European countries are simply shutting their borders and becoming more restrictive or in allowing people to enter, and in some cases even building walls and fences. And in our view, this is not the solution. It's precisely in moments like this that Europe has to remember its values. And also, it's important to realize that Europe cannot simply hide behind walls. We need to deal with this problem. There is a collective international responsibility to deal with this situation, because Europe's security and welfare and prosperity are linked to what happens in the rest of the world. Europe cannot be an island of security, peace, and stability when all around it you have conflict. We need to address the root causes of why people are fleeing, and that has to do with conflict and with lack of development in many parts of Africa and the Middle East. And the international community needs to be more active in solving and preventing conflict. And it's something that in the past Europe has managed to do. We also think that it's very important to create legal avenues for people who want to come to Europe, either for economic reasons and, more importantly, for those who are escaping war and persecution, so that they don't risk their lives in this way. If we look into the possibilities of family reunification, if we look also at the possibility of resettlement from other countries, humanitarian admission programs, and so on, we will ensure that those who come in a safe, orderly, organized way. In that way, countries that receive them will be prepared, and these people will not be risking their lives unnecessarily.
William Spindler is a spokesman for the UN Refugee Agency, the UNHCR. From Geneva, he spoke to VOA's Joe DiCapua.
Survivors say a suicide bomber killed more than 10 people in a northeastern Nigeria village yesterday. Witnesses say the young female bomber blew herself up as she entered a market in Gujaba, a town once occupied by Boko Haram insurgents. The explosion, the second attack on the town in the same day, injured more than 20 bystanders. Northeast Nigeria has been a battleground between the Nigerian military and a violent six-year Boko Haram extremist effort to create a caliphate. The militaries of Chad, Cameroon, and Niger have joined the fight to defeat the extremists.
More than 90 minutes into the debate, South African lawmakers were still launching angry verbal assaults on President Jacob Zuma and on each other. The bitterness was perhaps best expressed by opposition.
Well, insults flew in South Africa's parliament yesterday as members debated the government's decision to not arrest Sudan's president on an international genocide warrant during his recent visit. The debate exposed not only the different opinions about the government's actions, but also the deep acrimony that has lately come to define South African politics. VOA's Anita Powell reports from Johannesburg.
More than 90 minutes into the debate, South African lawmakers were still launching angry verbal assaults on President Jacob Zuma and on each other. The bitterness was perhaps best expressed by opposition politician Musiwa Lekota.
The leadership, President Zuma and his cabinet, and those who colluded with this thing, do not deserve to lead us. They have failed to uphold the constitution of our land. The oaths you made mean nothing. You lied to us. You said you'd uphold the Constitution, uphold the law, and be the example. You have misled the people of our country. And now we are ashamed before the nations of the world.
Peter Mulder, another opposition party leader, said he thought this was the worst scandal the nation has seen in a while.
Sir, forget about FIFA. The al-Bashir crisis makes the FIFA version look like a Sunday school picnic.
Sudan's President Omar al-Bashir is wanted by the International Criminal Court on charges that he masterminded a genocide in Sudan's Darfur region, where his government has been fighting rebels since 2003. He has denied the charges. The Sudanese president is long gone after briefly touching down in Johannesburg for an African Union summit earlier this month. But the government's decision to not arrest him has snowballed into a huge issue in South Africa, especially given that officials ignored a court order that sought to keep him in the country. The government has argued that Mr. Bashir enjoyed diplomatic immunity as a summit attendee. The ruling African National Congress Party defended the decision during Tuesday's debate, saying the ICC unfairly prosecutes Africans. The party has also suggested that the nation consider withdrawing from the court. Here's Minister of Small Business Lindiwe Zulu, who has also served as Mr. Zuma's special advisor on international relations.
Honorable Speaker, can these members really think we are going to arrest a head of state? They must think again.
The ANC found an unlikely ally in this argument in the Economic Freedom Fighters. The rowdy, youth-centric EFF party has harangued Mr. Zuma for the use of government funds to upgrade his private home. But EFF member Floyd Shivambu backed the ANC on this issue and said South Africa would have created a crisis by arresting Mr. Bashir.
And also it was naive for the whoever took the government to court to think that it can be wise to arrest a head of state here in South Africa. It was going to lead to instability in the origin country where he came from. It was going to even threaten our security in South Africa.
The most heated part of the debate came as Deputy Justice Minister John Jeffrey discussed the legal issues raised by the court order and took a shot at Opposition Chief Whip John Steenhuisen.
Now, Deputy Speaker, without making any comment on the circumstances of President Bashir's departure, what would have happened? Because it is still before the courts, you idiot. I withdraw that.
Point of order.
I withdraw that.
No. Sorry.
Yes.
Sorry, the Honourable Member can't just make a statement that is derogatory to another member and then just simply say, I withdraw. Speaker, Deputy Speaker, you cannot have a member in this House calling another member an idiot.
And on that bitter note, the debate ended. But this argument, and with it South Africa's political divide, is far from over. Anita Pell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
Minutes past the hour. This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. Well, over the past 21 years, there's been a huge drop in the number of Africa's lions. The International Union for Conservation of Nature reports that the lion population has been reduced by 42% during that period. The Animal Welfare and Conservation Organization, Born Free USA, is calling for immediate international action to halt what it calls catastrophic declines. Adam M. Roberts is CEO of Born Free USA. He says their research attributes the disappearance of lions to a number of factors.
Born Free's research over a number of years has shown that the decline of lions across Africa is really from myriad factors. You obviously have habitat decline as humans compete with wild animals for portions of the landscape, but then you also have disease that runs through wildlife populations. But I think probably the most prevalent problem for Africa's lions is the human-caused influences from poaching. It could be retaliatory killing for lions who have killed livestock and as a result are either speared or rather gruesomely poisoned in retaliation. And then you have human trophy hunters, which is especially problematic for American trophy hunters, taking literally hundreds and hundreds of lions each year simply for a so-called sport. And when you put all of these factors together, you really find that there's a problematic situation that's imperiling the species across the continent.
Why is the lion population decline in southern Africa not as significant as it is elsewhere in Africa?
Well, I think the first thing when you explore sort of the different levels of decline across the continent that you have to do is sort of understand the dynamics. And when you look at the sheer numbers, you realize that the levels of decline or the rates of decline may not be as profound in certain southern African countries as elsewhere, but you're still dealing with a rather small population across the continent. So when you're dealing with perhaps 32,000 lions across Africa, knowing that there may be 10,000 in South Africa, but only, say, 1,000 or 1,200 in Ethiopia isn't such a stark difference. But I think it's sheer issues of money and resources and the availability of habitat protection and wildlife conservation efforts. South Africa obviously has the biggest and most booming economy across the continent, and so surely one would expect them to have more resources being put into conservation. But that doesn't, of course, mean that there aren't problems in those southern African countries where poaching is pronounced. And in South Africa, you have this compounding problem of lions being bred in captivity and then being sold around the world, which creates a problem for everyone when these lions get sold into the pet trade or for their bones in Asia. You end up with lions in Ethiopia, in Kenya, and elsewhere being poached from the wild and smuggled in for that same purpose. So it's really a continent-wide problem, not just a problem between, say, North and South.
What type of action then is needed to protect the lion population in Africa?
Well, I think the first thing we have to do is recognize that there's a global responsibility to protect lions. It's not just about what individual African governments are doing or are capable of doing. Born Free has been instrumental, for example, in working with the Convention on Migratory Species to recognize the threats to lions and the need to have cross-boundary protections put in to protect the species. As well, we were part of a group of organizations in 2011 that petitioned the U.S. Department of the Interior to list the lion as endangered under the Endangered Species Act, which would drastically reduce the number of trophies that are coming into America and ensure that America could play a vital positive role in the conservation of the species across Africa. And we're still waiting for a final decision from the Fish and Wildlife Service about the status of the lion under the ESA, but that would be a pronounced positive impact if we could get lions so listed. And then, of course, there's the Convention on International Trade in Endangered Species, or CITES, that can take great responsibility for increasing the level of protection for lions and therefore decreasing the number of lions that are allowed to be commercially traded globally. So we really need an integrated global approach to ensuring that Africa's lions exist in perpetuity.
You mentioned earlier about the loss of the habitat. How does this loss of habitat affect how lions hunt and eat?
So as humans integrate themselves into the wild landscape, it actually has a significant impact on the behavior of lions and their ability to exist in the ecosystem in which they've obviously thrived for a very long time. One of the most profound ways that happens is that as humans expand their settlements into wild habitat, you have a decreasing availability of habitat for lions, which then results in the lions perhaps changing their diet patterns from wild animals, including antelope, for example, and starting to prey more and more on different species, but also the human livestock. And that creates that human-lion conflict that has significantly negative consequences for lions wherever that happens. So the more that we don't protect lions in the wild where they belong, the more conflict you're going to have and the greater the threat on the species.
Adam M. Roberts is CEO of Born for USA. He spoke with me from Washington, D.C.
In the Democratic Republic of Congo, many teachers are paid months late, if they are paid at all. In remote areas, teacher salaries are distributed by the Catholic Church-run organization Caritas, which some politicians and teachers suggest is not up to the task. But as Nick Long reports from Goma, Caritas defends its record and says the real problems lie elsewhere.
In the last session of the DRC Parliament, which ended on June the 15th, opposition lawmaker Fabien Mouton called for an urgent parliamentary inquiry into what he called grey areas around government workers' pay. Among those grey areas, he suggested, were the details of the government's contract with the Catholic organisation Caritas, which distributes the salaries of state school teachers in parts of the country without banks. Mouton recommended handing back that responsibility to local government. A spokesman for the teachers' union in Goma, Jean-Luc Ndaelitse, told VOA teachers are dissatisfied with Caritas's performance.
Nous avons des propositions. Caritas améliore ses services jusqu'à ce que...
We have two propositions, he says. Either Caritas improves its service so that teachers are paid on time, or Caritas must give up the contract with the government and allow the government to relaunch banks where teachers can be paid. Most teachers paid through the Caritas office in Goma have not been paid for the past 2 months, says Ndaelitse.
Oui, nous avons, par exemple, le territoire de Rutshuru.
For example, he says in Rutshuru and Lubero territories, teachers still have not been paid for December and January because Caritas's vehicle was held up by bandits, and they've also not been paid for April and May, which makes 4 months arrears. A Caritas spokesman in Goma, Abbe Arsène Masumbuko, told VOA the delays are not Caritas's fault.
Alors, les arriérés s'expliquent facilement.
He says the arrears are easily explained, as the money can be held up between the government and Caritas's national headquarters in Kinshasa because sometimes there are administrative problems. The main problem, he told VOA, is disagreements over who should cover the high transport costs, the government or Caritas. In North Kivu, insecurity is the main reason for the high cost. Caritas used to transport the money by road to the many Catholic parishes where it was collected by school directors. But in some areas, this is no longer possible, and the money has to go by air. North Kivu's most remote territory, Walikale, is a real problem, says Masumbuko. He says Caritas was counting on using UN mission planes for Walikale, but the UN mission refused, and it is difficult to use commercial flights as they land 25 kilometres from Walikale's main town, which is a security risk. In the past year and a half, Caritas in Goma lost $130,000 when one of its vehicles carrying teacher pay was ambushed, and another of these vehicles was chased by bandits who may also have stolen teacher pay.
Le même militaire qui est soupçonné pour le premier braquage est celui-là qui nous a poursuivi.
Abbé Masumbuko says the same army officer who is suspected of committing the first of those robberies also chased the second vehicle to a parish and threatened Caritas staff. He added that the army officer has been removed from his post but has not been put on trial. Despite his criticisms of Caritas, Ndaelitse says the organisation does a far better job of getting money to teachers than the government managed in the past. Previously, he said, teachers received only about 70% of their salaries, and the rest was deducted by the administrative hierarchy, but now they receive nearly all of their salaries. Besides many teachers being paid late, many are not paid at all in DRC. Ndaelitse said about 30% of teachers at state schools receive no salary from the government. The local education authority in Goma said locally it was more like 45%, as many new schools have been opening and their staff are not yet on the government payroll. Ruth Habimana was an unpaid teacher for several years before she resigned. They often promised us we would be paid, she says, and when a year had gone by, they said, you'll be paid next year. And the years passed like that. Nick Long for VOA News, Goma.
This is Africa News Tonight in Washington. It's 29 minutes past the hour.
Looking for something? Headline news, interviews, analysis? We've got it all on voaafrica.com.
voaafrica.com.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. Here's a brief recap of our top stories this hour. Security officials say there was a targeted assassination attempt on the life of a United Arab Emirates diplomat today in Mogadishu. Hungary says it will suspend processing of asylum seekers registered within its borders because of a rising tide of refugees. And survivors say a suicide bomber killed more than 10 people in a northeastern Nigeria village yesterday. Coming up, we'll have music from Cameroon. And in our feature segment, the UN chief welcomes Pope Francis' encyclical call for swift action in mitigating climate change. I'm Kim Lewis with Yehia Swuhib, and we're live from Washington. This is Africa News Tonight on the VOA. Sports with Sunny is next. Time now for the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young. Happy Wednesday, Sunny.
Happy Wednesday to you, Kim.
Well, Sunny, I understand you are kicking off with Women's World Cup football.
Kim, the field for the quarterfinals is now set at the Women's World Cup football tournament in Canada. Defending champion Japan earned the last quarterfinal berth with a 2-1 victory over the Netherlands in Vancouver, Canada. Sayori Ariyoshi opened the scoring for the Japanese in the 10th minute. Mizuo Sakaguchi scored her team's second goal in the 78th minute on a pretty left-footed shot before Kirsten van de Ven pulled one back for the Dutch ladies in extra time. The Japanese will next play Australia Saturday in the quarterfinals in Edmonton, Canada. In the other quarterfinal matchups, the United States, who lost to the Japanese on penalty kicks in the 2011 Women's World Cup final in Germany. They'll play China on Friday in Ottawa, Canada. Also Friday, France will face two-time world champion Germany in Montreal, Canada. And I think France will have plenty of support from the fans in French-speaking Montreal. They'll need that crowd support because the German women have been very impressive in Canada so far, scoring 19 goals while giving up only two. And let's give a quick sunny side of sports shout out for two German players, Anja Mittag and Celia Sasic, who are the tournament's joint leading scorers with five goals each. In the last Women's World Cup quarterfinal, host Canada will play England Saturday in Vancouver. Looking ahead to next week, semifinal matches will be played June 30th in Montreal and July 1st in Edmonton. Edmonton will also stage the third place match July 4th, and the Women's World Cup final will be played July 5th in Vancouver. Joining us once again on the sunny side of sports is David Legg, our African football guru. Good evening, David.
Good evening, Sunny.
David, let's kick off with the Women's World Cup in Canada. We've reached the quarterfinal stage, and unfortunately for African football fans, none of the three African teams reached the final eight. Let's go team by team, David, beginning with Cameroon, which made it to the round of 16. Your thoughts?
Yes, Sonny, the round of 16, and unfortunately that's where it ended for Cameroon. A 1-0 defeat by China, a brave performance by the Cameroonians. But afterwards, the coach, and now in Chu, very angry, although I'm going to have to take issue with a couple of things. He says, the day we are prepared well, an African nation will be able to win the World Cup. We hope that with this performance, many things will change, not just in Cameroon, but in Africa. Now sunny comes the part that leaves me cold, so to speak. He said, we didn't expect cold weather and rain. It was a handicap for our team. Now, Sonny, if I'm a coach and I'm going to Canada in the middle of the year, one of the first things I'm going to check are the weather conditions, because obviously it affects your footwear and it could also affect your tactics. And surely the Cameroon coach should have known that cold weather was a possibility and also rain was a possibility. So I think another strong point there for the coach. And he says it's also unfortunate that we have been training on surfaces that are not very slippery. Well, hopefully the next time round, memo to all African coaches, check the conditions, check where you're going to play. I mean, if you're going to play in Canada, check Canadian conditions. If you're going to play in Thailand, check the conditions there. It can have quite a big bearing on the outcome. But nevertheless, Sonny, a high five to Cameroon, the only African team, as you said, to make it through the knockout stage.
Ivory Coast making its debut at the Women's World Cup. Your thoughts on the Ivorian ladies?
Well, they, of course, Sonny, got off to that horrendous start. 10-0 defeat by Germany. They improved quite a bit against Thailand, lost 3-2. And then in the final game against Norway, who were a pretty strong outfit when it comes to women's football, they lost 3-1. So I think on the positive side, Sonny, much improved performances after that horrendous start against the Germans. The coach of the Ivorians also came up with an interesting quote. He said, we arrived 72 hours before the game, and that's referring to the match against Germany, and we were very tired from a long journey of 15 hours and jet lag. Now, again, Sonny, it begs the question, why, when you're facing a mighty team like Germany, do you arrive just 3 days before the match? It cannot be finances, because the Canadians foot all the bills for a team once they arrive in the country. And I'm extremely sure that countries were allowed to arrive probably a week in advance. And I regret to say, Sonny, a very hard lesson has probably been learned by the Ivorians and hopefully also by their coach, Clementine Toure. And that is, come well prepared. The Germans are among the strongest teams in the world. And the Ivorians should have been there probably a week in advance to acclimatize properly. So all in all, Sonny, it doesn't seem as if the African team's preparations were top-notch for the Women's World Cup.
The Super Falcons of Nigeria have been the most successful women's team in Africa over the years, but they also left Canada in disappointment. They were eliminated by the United States 1-0. Your thoughts on the Nigerian women, David?
Yeah, well put, Sonny. In fact, Nigeria have won 9 of the 11 African championships, so they are very much the queens of African football. But they have only once advanced past the group stage of the World Cup, so there's something wrong there. Now, the Super Falcons got off to a really good start in that they drew 3-3 against Sweden, a powerhouse in women's football. But then they lost 2-0 to Australia. And that meant, Sonny, they faced a must-win match against the United States. And the United States, of course, one of the forces in women's world football. And in a sense, you could probably say Nigeria did reasonably well in restricting the Americans to a one-goal victory. But when you need a win, a defeat is absolutely no use to you. So it was a very early exit for the Nigerians. So all in all, Sonny, a lot of lessons to be learned. And let's hope by the time the 2019 Women's World Cup comes around in France, that things like the weather conditions and the state of the pitches, etc., will not be issues.
Thanks, David. That's our African football guru, David Legg, speaking with us once again from Johannesburg, South Africa. Tanzania has hired a new coach for its national football team, as we hear now from the VOA's Daybreak Africa sportsman, Mark Ouma.
Boniface Mkasa is the new Tanzania Taifa Stars coach. The Tanzania Football Federation president Jamal Malinzi told the media in Dar es Salaam on Tuesday. A former Tanzanian international player, Mkasa, takes over from Dutchman Matt Norge, who was sacked following 5 consecutive matches in which Taifa Stars were defeated.
The Voice of America, VOA.
Turning to athletics, Nigeria's top home-based athletes compete at the Athletics Federation of Nigeria Golden League meet in Kaduna, North Central Nigeria, today, Wednesday. While younger competitors have a final opportunity to prove their ability before the World Youth Championships due in Cali, Colombia next month, the senior athletes are vying to qualify for the World Athletics Championships due in Beijing, China in August.
This is Larry Zamuje, Chairman, Chief Executive, Sports Radio 80.9, Brilla FM, Lagos and Abuja, Nigeria. Let's talk to you about Brilla FM. It's Nigeria's only sports station. Of course, we partner the VOA. VOA! And so you can listen to Sunny Side of Sports on 80.9, Brilla FM, Lagos and Abuja. Keep listening, Africa, and enjoy Sunny Side of Sports on Brilla.
Thanks, Dr. Larry. In addition to sports radio, 88.9 Brilla FM stations in Lagos and Abuja, Dr. Larry also has stations in Kaduna and Onitsha, Nigeria. We're delighted to be your partner, Dr. Larry, so keep it sporty.
The Voice of America, VOA.
They're playing back.
The National Basketball Association will hold its annual draft of college and international players on Thursday night in New York City. The NBA draft will take place at Barclays Center Arena in Brooklyn, the home of the NBA's Brooklyn Nets Club. Under the draft format, the league's 30 clubs make their selections over two rounds. The Minnesota Timberwolves have the number one pick, and they're expected to take either Karl Anthony Towns from the University of Kentucky or Jahlil Okafor of Duke University. And this quick African link about the 19-year-old Okafor: he was born in the southern U.S. state of Arkansas, but his grandfather is from Nigeria. Another 19-year-old player with African ties who's expected to be one of the top picks is Emmanuel Mudiay, who was born in Kinshasa, the capital of the Democratic Republic of Congo. Mudiay played last season for the Guangdong Southern Tigers in the Chinese Basketball Association. Emmanuel signed a one-year contract with the Tigers worth more than $1 million, but he played in only 12 games because of an ankle injury. And this Sunny Side of Sports programming note, VOA's Tadi Abeje will have more on the 2015 NBA draft during Thursday's show. Follow the Sunny Side of Sports on Facebook and Twitter. My Facebook address is facebook.com/VOA Sunny, and my Twitter handle is @VOA Sunny Sports. If you go to my Facebook page, you'll see an interesting article on Emmanuel Mudiay. In more NBA news, the Charlotte Hornets will host the 2017 NBA All-Star Game at Time Warner Cable Arena in Charlotte, North Carolina. And I'm sure that news brings a smile to the face of NBA great Michael Jordan, who is the owner of the Hornets. The 2016 NBA All-Star Game will be played February 14th at Air Canada Center in Toronto, the home of the NBA's Toronto Raptors Club. This will be the first time the popular exhibition contest is staged outside the United States. I'm VOA's Sonny Young, and that's the Sunny Side of Sports. Back to Yahias Wuhib and Kim Lewis.
Thank you, Sonny. And listen to the Sunny Side of Sports Monday through Friday at 1631 UTC and 1831 UTC. And on Fridays, Sonny has an expanded half-hour edition of the Sunny Side of Sports at 1730 hours UTC, right here on the Voice of America.
Coming up, the UN Secretary General welcomes Pope Francis's encyclical calling for swift action on mitigating climate change. And next, Al-Shabaab militants recruiting thousands of young people in Kenya. But first, some music. Here is Julius Essoka of Cameroon with Dikom.
samorita de nongona bunga jepe sepe bori puri majita nabi lumbu petembusa nei matoki sane umwate ma umwate wa bisa morita de yo nambodi di bulia di latana bobi minya masu nutu yasu minyenge mese malebon disi matoki sane Samorita so doti na unyenge Umba pete mba, umba pete wa Numbu te wande, numbu pete mba vene Chepe ma Chepe madie Ele mule mamongo Waola kise Pa tabole mule mlena la kise Nasi binga babunya Bomele po Nari bene dube Nasibinga bobunya mo umere po Nari bene de malakisa
Julius Esoka of Cameroon with Dikom.
While the UN Secretary General has welcomed Pope Francis' encyclical calling for swift action on mitigating climate change, from the UN, VOA's Margaret Bashir reports that international negotiations are continuing in the lead-up to the final conference this December in Paris, where countries will aim to make significant commitments to lessen the impact of global warming for future generations.
The lengthy papal letter called on the world to combat global warming to prevent damaging the environment and ruining the planet. UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon has made ambitious action on climate change one of his signature issues since taking the helm of the UN nearly a decade ago. Mr. Ban has found in the Roman Catholic leader an ally in his efforts, and the two have met several times.
I thank deeply Pope Francis for taking such a strong stand on the need for urgent global action. His moral voice is part of a growing chorus of people from all faiths and all sectors of society speaking out for climate action. I urge all the governments to place the global common good above national interests and to adopt an ambitious universal climate agreement in Paris this year.
The international community will meet in Paris in December with the intention of agreeing a universal, legally binding climate treaty with the goal of limiting global warming to less than 2 degrees Celsius a year by 2020, when the deal would go into force. The latest round of negotiations just finished in Bonn, Germany. UN climate change expert Cassie Flynn attended those talks. She said delegates discussed what elements will be within the Paris deal and what will be in a series of decisions that will support it.
And within this discussion is the series of what are the levers that countries need to be able to achieve ambitious contributions to this global goal that we have set of 2 degrees. And what are the financial pieces? What are the capacity building pieces? What are the technical pieces that countries need?
In these 6 months leading to Paris, Flynn said discussions would focus on mitigation, adaptation, and the financial and capacity building components of dealing with global warming. Financing is a key issue, as countries agreed in 2009 to mobilize $100 billion a year from public and private sources starting in 2020 for mitigating climate change. So far, only 38 countries have announced their pledges for reducing greenhouse gas emissions, among them the United States and China, which together account for nearly a third of global emissions. The United States has said it plans to reduce emissions by 26% to 28% from 2005 levels by 2025. China has also agreed to limit its emissions, committing to peak emissions around 2030 and making best efforts to peak early. Beijing also plans to increase its share of non-fossil fuel consumption to around 20% by 2030. The next round of climate negotiations is scheduled for early September. Pope Francis will address the United Nations September 25th and is likely to cover climate change in his remarks. Also that month, Mr. Bon will host a summit on sustainable development that will focus on the importance of protecting the environment while promoting growth. Margaret Bashir, VOA News, the United Nations.
The Al-Shabaab militants that have long battled for control of Somalia also have recruited thousands of young people in Kenya, leaving many families unhappy. Mohamed Yusuf recently visited the Kenyan town of Isolo and met with relatives of those recruited, as well as many who have helped with the recruiting.
A group of women meeting in a quiet corner of an open-air restaurant in Isiolo talk about their fears, their struggles to get their loved ones back from the Somali militant group Al-Shabaab, and how to keep others away from the hands of recruiters. For Zainab Hashi, the wound still fresh. She says her son left home on May 1st for what she thought was to be an Islamic retreat. A week later, a call came. She says, I lost my son. One day he disappeared. He left here on the first day of this month. He was with other 4 boys. She goes on to say, they said they were in Leboy, a town on the Kenya-Somalia border. And when she asked why didn't he call her, they said he was afraid, but that he was fine. But then they told her the Kenyan security forces had arrested them. She says a week later, her teenage son and 3 others were still in custody in Leboy, accused of trying to cross over the border to join Al-Shabaab. Hashi seeks comfort and advice from another woman, Halima Hassan, who says her own teenage brother has been with Al-Shabaab for 8 months. She says before he left, he asked for about $40 for a school trip, and that was the last time her family saw him. 3 weeks later, he called home and told his family that he was with Al-Shabaab making a lot of money and he was fine. However, Hassan fears for the worst. She says there is no way he can be found. He has become a criminal who has no sympathy and kills people. But she says she will pray for God to guide him. Each time she sees his schoolmates, Hassan says, she feels bad and cries. She says she has yet to understand why he chose a gun instead of a pen and a book. The vast network that lures in young men to join jihad starts with the recruiters on the ground. VOA met one of these local contacts, a man named Ali, who gave only his first name. He is in his early 20s and says he was involved in Al-Shabaab recruitment activities in Isiolo. He says his work was just to look for idle young men and bring them to the mosque, and from there, other people take over. Ali says he was told the boys can go for an Islamic retreat for about 4 months and can come to the mosque. He says they wanted such youths because they sinned a lot, and God can forgive them. Later, he says, he heard that young men he took to the mosque for Islamic instruction went to Al-Shabaab. Ali says he stopped looking for recruits and no longer is involved in such activities. However, some people in Isiolo told VOA he was still in the business. Ali is part of a long chain of people involved in jihadi recruitment, and the work is shrouded in secrecy. Late April, Kenyan security agencies published a list of 85 people involved in terror-related activities. One of those people is Abdi Ibrahim Aden, a primary school teacher in Isiolo. He denies being involved in terrorism, but admits some people on the list should be questioned about the goods trade between Kenya and Somalia.
I believe there were some people who are genuinely supposed to be questioned because they are doing, I don't know if they are doing now, but they were doing business with Somalia in getting sugar. Sugar is under Al-Shabaab control in Somalia.
Aden says more than 200 students have not reported to his school this year, and no one knows their whereabouts. Zainab Hashi and Halima Hassan, like many relatives of those who have joined Al-Shabaab, say they do not know who recruited their sons into the ranks of the terror group. Kenyan authorities say the Somali militants continue to recruit in the country. Parents say it leaves them feeling powerless against an enemy working day and night to lure away their children. Mohammed Yusuf for VOA News, Isiolo, Kenya.
This is African News Tonight on the Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz. Tune in to African News Tonight at 16 and 18 hours UTC, Monday through Friday. And with that, we wrap up this edition of African News Tonight. Up next, our VOA editorial. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at www.voaafrica.com. And on behalf of our African News Tonight producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Nelson Lopes, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
An alliance of political separatists has signed a groundbreaking peace deal with the government of Mali, a hopeful step towards ending decades of fighting in the troubled West African nation. The Algerian brokered agreement, signed by a representative of the Rebel Coordination of Movements of Azawad, will grant greater autonomy to sparsely populated and restive northern Mali, a bid to end a cycle of uprisings there since the nation gained its independence from France in 1960. The Algiers Accord had been signed in May by a coalition of loyalist armed groups, but the CMA held out for concessions on the return of refugees, security arrangements, and development plans for the region. These were agreed with the government this month. Separatists have rebelled four times since independence. In 2012, they formed an alliance with Islamist militants to seize the desert north. If French-led military intervention scattered the insurgents, although isolated, sporadic attacks have continued. The deal will leave the issue of Azawad's political identity for a national debate between Malian parties. The government has said it is prepared to devolve more authority under Mali's existing decentralized structure, but rejects demands for full autonomy within a federal system. In signing the agreement, the CMA said it is placing hope for a fair settlement with the government. The United States congratulates the Malian people, including the parties to the peace negotiations undertaken in Algiers, for the full signature of the Accord for Peace and Reconciliation in Mali, achieved June 21st in Bamako. We commend the parties for their commitment to compromise and to resolving their differences through dialogue. We wish to thank the Algerian government for serving as lead mediator throughout the negotiations and underscore our continuing support for international peacekeepers there as we enter the implementation phase of the peace process. We will continue to stand by the Malian people as they take the lead in implementing the accord and bringing about the future of peace and prosperity that all Malians deserve.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.
When news is happening, VOA Africa is there.
Mohamed Yusuf of VOA News, Nairobi.
Victor Beatty, VOA News, Washington.
Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
For VOA News, I am Charlton Doki in Joba.
Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News, Yaoundé.
VOA correspondents take you right to the center of events as they're happening. And this is where you hear it all on VOA Africa.